You are Locked On Bills, your daily Buffalo Bills podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
What's up, Bills Mafia? It's Joe Marino from the Draft Network, and I'm your host of Locked On Bills. Happy Tuesday to you, and thank you for making Locked On Bills your first listen every day. It's herd mentality again here on the podcast as we get back into our normal swing of things, and you guys sent in some great stuff for us to talk about here today on the podcast, so let's do just that. First one comes from Chris, who says, "How concerned are you that we've spent 3 years building to challenge the imploding Chiefs and not the wily and ascendant Tennessee Titans? Two fairly different teams with substantially different offensive profiles." So I think we have to respect what the Titans have been able to accomplish over the last couple of weeks. I mean, they lost to the Jets earlier in the season, but they've ripped off consecutive wins against the Buffalo Bills and the Kansas City Chiefs. They've had a really nice stretch. Here's what I would say about Tennessee. They're going to run away with the AFC South. They're going to run away with that division. Jacksonville, Houston, and Indianapolis are the three other teams in the South. So they're going to get that home playoff game at least for the first round. But my concern with Tennessee is that it's just not a very deep roster. They have good players, but the depth isn't there, and they have holes. And I think that catches up with them at some point this season. The other thing is their way of winning, to me, is a very tough script where they really rely on Derrick Henry in that running game to make their offense go. And they are giving Derrick Henry the football a ton. And I'm just concerned that they don't have more than one way that they can win football games consistently. And defensively, I think this team has a lot of work to do in terms of personnel. So their roster lacks depth. They have a tough script that they cling to. And I just feel like there's too many questions when it comes to this defense, this offensive line. I don't take them seriously as a contender. And maybe I'll eat my words and look silly for saying that, but I think Tennessee will be a good division champion, and I think their season stalls out either in the wild card or divisional round. The next one today comes from Muck, who says, "My question for you is, how important do you believe it is to have that first round bye and home field in the playoffs? And how many losses do you think we can have in order to make that happen?" Muck, I do think it's really important. I think playing games at Highmark Stadium in the playoffs is critical. I mean, the Bills won every game they've ever played at Highmark Stadium in the playoffs under Coach McDermott. The two they didn't play there, they lost. One in Kansas City, one in Jacksonville, and the other in Houston. So three. They're 2-3 in the playoffs under McDermott. All three losses came on the road. So I think that right there says a lot about the importance of playing home playoff games. So I want them all played at home, and securing that bye is important. The Bills have a very early bye week this year. It already happened in week 7, and the Bills have a long stretch of games. And if we're talking about going to the Super Bowl, it's a really long stretch. And I know that the Bills have a mini bye when they play on Thursday Night Football on Thanksgiving Day, and then they don't play again until Monday Night Football. But still, I think that's just a lot of weeks in a row where the Bills will have to play games, and I think whether it's a physical or a mental reset, the Bills would absolutely benefit from having that first round bye, not to mention it's one less game that they have to play. The next one today comes from Paul. Paul says, "What even is the AFC pecking order at this point? The Chiefs and Browns are falling apart, the Bengals are leading the AFC North somehow, and the Titans, flawed as they are making a legitimate case for the coveted one seed. Hoping you can make sense of all this and give us an idea of where the Bills stand in this mess of a playoff picture. Thanks and go Bills." So Paul, I'm going to give you the most boring answer imaginable. But let's play all 17 games and see what happens. I mean, we've all followed football long enough to know that it just doesn't matter if you're the darling of the league in week 7. Right now, the number one seed in the AFC is the Bengals. the number one seed in the NFC is the Cardinals. Let's play them all and see where it all lands. I mean, there's only been seven games played by these teams. That's just not enough of a sample size for this to sort itself out. And it will. It always takes care of itself. I think the Bills are one of the best teams in the AFC, if not the best. I'd love to play the Titans again. I'd love it. Bring on the Bengals. Bring on the Ravens. Bring on the Chargers. The Bills are capable of beating every single team in the NFL. And despite a 4-2 record, I think the Bills are still one of, if not the best team in the NFL. The next one today comes from Steven, who says, "Thanks for the great podcast. It helps me stay connected to my Buffalo roots from Denver. My earliest memories were watching the Bills in the early 90s, and the end of last year was the first time I woke up to the idea the Bills could be a serious contender in the Super Bowl. Looking at the records of teams in the NFC, I'm wondering if you think the conferences are evenly matched or if there's a risk we're moving into a bigger pond." So, I think the AFC is clearly a better conference than the NFC. But I still think the NFC has some really good teams. Look at the Rams, the Bucks, the Cardinals are undefeated somehow. They're playing really well. It's not just that they're undefeated, they're playing good football. The Packers, Cowboys. I don't think it's nearly as deep as the AFC, but those are five teams that look like serious contenders at this point in the season. And we expected that from the Packers, Bucks, and Rams. But the AFC is deeper. It's arguably better at the top. And it definitely appears to be a much tougher course to the Super Bowl. Hey, Bills fans, this is Joe Marino with an incredible app everyone who buys gas needs to know about, Get Upside. My listeners are making up to 25 cents for every gallon of gas every time they fill up. Just download the free Get Upside app in the App Store or Google Play right now and use promo code TOUCHDOWN to get a bonus 25 cents per gallon on your first fill up. That's up to 50 cents cash back. Don't pay full price at the pump anymore. Get cash back using Get Upside. Just download the app for free and use promo code TOUCHDOWN to get up to 50 cents per gallon cash back on your first tank. Some people who drive a lot are making as much as $200 to $300 a month in cash back, and there's no catch. The cash back gets added right to your account, and you can cash out at any time to your bank account, PayPal, or an e-gift card for Amazon and other brands. Just download the free Get Upside app and use promo code TOUCHDOWN. Have you ever tried to scoop that last bit of salsa out of a bowl, and right at the last pivotal moment, the chip breaks? The chip disappears into the salsa, your hand plunges deeper into the bowl, and you're left with the dreaded salsa knuckles. When you're stressing about whether or not we should go for it on a fourth down, it's the last thing you need. Well, I have a solution for you. Zach's Mighty Tortilla Chips. They know that the purpose of a tortilla chip is to successfully deliver dips from the bowl to your mouth in one delicious piece. Their chips are sturdy, corny, and live to keep your knuckles clean. That's because their chips are cut and fried from real tortillas, while most chips on the shelf skip this step. On top of that, their delicious Flint corn is organically grown in the Buffalo, Rochester area. So pick up a bag at your local Wegmans or Whole Foods market today and say no to weak and crappy tortilla chips forever. The next one today comes from Kyle, who says, "Social media just isn't the same this weekend with the Bills on the bye. We all know that the Buffalo Bills social media team is elite, but what player on the team do you enjoy following the most? Sure, Beasley got a lot of negative attention during the offseason and a few weeks ago. However, we know that this team is full of good guys, and there are a lot of players that use their platform in so many positive ways." So it's a good question, Kyle. I'll say this, during the season, the players are pretty boring. I mean, I follow, I think, all of them on Instagram, and they don't really put much on there during the season. But I will say, in the offseason, I really enjoy Stephon Diggs and Jordan Poyer. They show a lot of their workouts, which is really fun to see the different stuff that they're doing on a regular basis. Jerry Hughes is usually pretty fun. I think he's the guy that is the most consistent year-round in terms of giving you some glimpses of what he's got going on and always hanging out with his family and his dogs, and I enjoy seeing that. And then when Trey White had his Instagram going, he was really, really good. He'd give you some of those locker room videos, and he was always, you know, cracking jokes at the guys and stuff. And so that was fun to see. But he deleted his Instagram, and we lost the gold that was Trey White on Instagram. But I think overall, the Bills are definitely a team of really good people, but from a social media perspective, I don't think there's that many great personalities. Maybe Deion Dawkins, but for the most part, I think the Bills are kind of boring on social media, and I think that's what you want from your players. The next one today comes from Zach. Zach says, I noticed in the Tennessee game that when Tyler Bass was kicking off, he took a much shorter run-up on the kick on kickoffs. I assume it's because the team doesn't just want him to kick it out of the end zone with that huge leg of his, and they want the opponent to have to return the kick and have the coverage unit tackle them before they make it to the 25-yard line, resulting in worse field position. I like this strategy, but I'm concerned about the risk-reward ratio. Is gaining the few yards in field position worth giving up on a kick return touchdown? I know the kick coverage on the Bills special teams unit is very good. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Thank you for your incredible insight that you share on the podcast. So I agree with you that there is some level of concern about the risk reward. I think you perfectly identified why the Bills chose to kick it short and have Tyler Bass not do his typical run up is because they were daring Tennessee to return the football because, obviously, number one, they didn't have much respect for whoever the return guy is for the Tennessee Titans, but also they felt that they could gain some field position advantage by pinning them deep. And if you guys remember going back to that game in 2020 between the Bills and Titans, it was a situation where the Bills could not get a field position advantage. And so maybe they were kind of dialed into that and trying to change those fortunes a little bit, and knowing that you're going up against a Derrick Henry offense where they're going to run the football a ton, just kind of give them more yards that they have to cover. And they were satisfied with the possibility of them advancing the football beyond the 25. The other thing that I'll say that comes to mind when considering this is the frequency of penalties on special teams plays. And so not only do you force them to return the football and you can stop them before the 25, but there's so many penalties called on special teams plays that the Bills maybe thought to themselves, well, if they return it, there's a higher chance that there will be a penalty called. And even if they get a decent return, you know, we're talking about pinning them back from the spot of a foul. And so that probably played into it as well. But it's definitely all field position. There is a risk-reward ratio to consider. But the Bills are an aggressive football team, and they're going to trust their guys to go out and make plays. And it's hard to argue with that philosophy because that's what I want to see. I want to see aggressiveness. I want to see trust in players, and I want to see them go out there and do it, go out there and perform. And Coach McDermott certainly gives his guys chances to do that. The next one comes from Alex, also very similar to one sent in by AJ and Mike. Alex says, when I look at the state of the AFC right now, I see a wide open window of opportunity for the Bills to make the Super Bowl this year. I am in favor of them making an all-in sort of move. I know building through the draft for the long term is important, but when an opportunity like this is there, I believe you have to pounce on it. I see three potential all-in targets that I would like the Bills to consider: Saquon Barkley, Marlon Mack, and Andrew Norwell. And he goes on to say, I would have included Miles Sanders until he got carted off with an ankle injury yesterday. How would you feel about a trade for one of these players? Are there any other realistic targets you would be in favor of trading for, or do you want the Bills to stand pat and trust the roster as it stands today? So, obviously, the trade deadline's coming up November 2nd, if I'm not mistaken. So, there's a chance the Bills make a move here to help their team. And what's interesting is the Bills are a really healthy football team, and so there's nothing that you can point to in terms of an injury that makes you say, oh my goodness, we lost this player, so we have to replace him and be aggressive on the trade market. I'm pretty satisfied with the Bills roster. Obviously, it can be improved in certain areas. The interior offensive line definitely stands out to me as a spot that I wouldn't mind seeing an investment. And I love the player you brought up there in Andrew Norwell. I know he's got that former Carolina Panther thing going, but he's a good guard in the NFL, 30 years old, has a manageable contract in terms of the Bills bringing him in. And, you know, if it doesn't work out, they can get out of that deal pretty reasonably after the season. And I think the biggest issue on the Bills right now is left guard. Well, Andrew Norwell, immediately gives you an answer in that position. So that's the one that's most interesting to me. I mean, Saquon Barkley is just always hurt. So that concerns me. Obviously, he's dynamic when he's on the field, but he's just not available very often. And then Marlon Mack doesn't move the needle at all for me. He's coming off of an Achilles injury, and Achilles injuries for running backs, it is literally the kiss of death. I mean, there's literally no success story out there that you can point to in terms of a running back coming back from an Achilles injury. I mean, Google running backs and Achilles, you will see all of this great research that's out there. There's no success stories that you can point to. And I'm pretty underwhelmed by Marlon Mack in general. I mean, even when this guy was healthy, they still went out and drafted Jonathan Taylor, and they still paid Nyheim Hines. And I don't know. I just think that says a lot about Marlon Mack. I think he's an overrated player. You know, I don't think he's a difference maker at running back. To me, he's really no different than what the Bills have. So I think he's a good player to bring up because he's requested a trade. And I think there's a good chance that he is traded, but I don't feel comfortable that he's actually an upgrade to what the Bills have. Now, if somebody gets injured, then maybe you consider it, but I'm not that high on Marlon Mack, to be honest with you. So I am okay if the Bills don't do anything. I think they have a Super Bowl caliber roster. If an injury happens, I reserve the right to change my mind. And of the players that you mentioned, I am most interested in Andrew Norwell. The next one today comes from Brian, who says, on a scale of Monday Night Football Leotis McKelvin to prime Devin Hester, how do you think Isaiah McKenzie has performed as the returner this year? I know that before the year you said you weren't confident in him due to his tendency to fumble returns. Has your stance changed, and are you now confident when you see him getting ready to return a kick? I think Isaiah McKenzie's done a nice job so far. He had the one blunder, I think, against Washington on the kick return where he let it hit the ground and didn't field the ball, and then the Washington football team recovered. But outside of that play, I think he's handled every single opportunity very, very well. I haven't been disappointed in the way he's fielded punts or made decisions on kick returns. I think he's done a nice job. I have no complaints. Now, he does have a long history of bad ball handling that I'm not going to quickly forget about. So there is a part of me that is still a little bit eager or anxious whenever I see McKenzie with the football, because I am aware of his ball handling, and I have followed McKenzie since he was at Georgia and, you know, his time in Denver and early on with the Bills. So all of that still weighs very heavily on me, but to his credit this year, he's done a great job, and I really don't have any complaints. I want to see him continue to handle the football well, and as that continues to happen, I will gain more and more confidence and comfort. But, you know, I'm still on edge a little bit because of just how poor his ball handling was prior to this season. But so far, so good. Next one comes from Chris. Chris says, what is your take on the rookie wall that occurs around Thanksgiving when the college season wraps up? I ask because two of the Bills' significant rookie contributors, Greg Rousseau and Spencer Brown, did not play football at all last year. Chris, I think this is a good point, not something I've considered to this point. But I will say this. You know that McDermott's aware. You know that Sean McDermott is completely dialed into the rookie wall, these players, the fact that they're contributing, and I'm sure he has a plan. And I'm not sure that there's an easy answer from me on this because I don't know exactly what he's going to do to preserve these players and gear them up for playing more football than they ever have in their entire life. But it's not something that's going to catch Sean McDermott off guard like it did me. But I do think it's something that we need to be mindful of. And if they do hit a wall and they're just not effective, the Bills have to pivot. They have to pivot and come up with a different plan because they need production out of their right tackle and starting left defensive end. So definitely something for us to be mindful of. Definitely something I think McDermott is mindful of. And we'll have to see how it all unfolds. But I think this is a really good underrated point that I hadn't considered here, Chris. So I appreciate you bringing that to the table. The next one comes from CG, who says, hey, Joe, love the pod with Greg Thompson this morning discussing roster construction and cap breakdown. It got me thinking about roster makeup from the lens of resource allocation, meaning draft capital and money. We all know that as you pay Allen, it makes it that much more important to build out a roster with more cheap labor, and hitting on draft picks is key. With that said, do teams also look at spending by position groups to forecast out potential needs and players to scout? For example, when I think about the Bills secondary, they are paying Trey, Hyde, Poyer, and now Taron Johnson pretty hefty salaries, which is why keeping Levi made sense versus spending big money in free agency. How do the Bills stack up versus other teams when it comes to dollars and draft picks allocated by position group, and how does that affect the way Bean and company attacks the offseason and builds out this roster for long-term success? Really good question, CG, and I have all the data here that I'm going to deliver in just a moment. I do first want to touch on that every team is going to approach this a little bit differently. Everybody's going to value things differently. And I know that for some general managers, there are positions that they are willing to spend on. And for them, it could be quarterback, left tackle, pass rusher, and corner. Or quarterback, offensive playmaker, left tackle, interior defensive tackle, playmaker on defense, right? Like, there's different things that everybody's going to approach differently. And I even heard it one time that during an NFL GM interview, part of what will be asked is for you to map out what percentage of the cap you want going to different position groups. So I definitely think that there are budgets per position group based on how they prioritize them. So it's definitely a thing. Now, what does the data tell us about the Bills and their priorities? So this is where the Bills fall, according to overthecap.com, on positional spending compared to the rest of the NFL. So at quarterback, the Bills are 17th, and this is just for this year. It's how much money they have this year in cap space committed to the position group. So this year, it's 17th in the NFL, but we know that in future years, it's going to be much higher. Running back is 23rd, wide receiver 11th, tight end 32, dead last, offensive line 9th. So the Bills offensively are spending the 18th most amount of money in the NFL on offense. On defense, interior defensive line is 9th, edge is 10th, linebacker 3rd, safety 3rd, and cornerback 20th. So the Bills have the 3rd most expensive defense in the NFL. So that's where it's at right now. Obviously, it changes year to year, but that gives you somewhat of an idea as to where the Bills have their priorities when it comes to spending. And it's pretty obvious that it's safety, linebacker, and defensive line, and offensive line. I mean, that's where they spend their money. They don't spend a lot of money on running backs and tight ends. They like wide receivers. They'll get by at corner, right? I mean, a lot of the thoughts that you have about the team, when you boil it down to the positional spending, it kind of lines up, and it's kind of fun to look at it through that lens. Football, baseball, basketball, hockey, it's all in season. It's that wonderful time of year where all of the major sports are going. NHL, NBA, they just got started. NFL is in full swing, and we have the World Series. So if you want to bet on sports, betonline.ag remains the number one spot to do so. Head to their new updated desktop or mobile website and sign up today, and you'll receive a 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit when you use our promo code Locked On. From basketball, football, baseball, NHL, boxing, UFC, they even have Vegas casino games. Don't wait to take advantage of all the amazing offers available for the 2021 season. BetOnline is the fastest and easiest way to bet on sports, and BetOnline is where the game starts. Today's episode is brought to you by RockAuto.com, a family business serving do-it-yourselfers for over 20 years. With the ever-increasing numbers of makes and models, it's now impossible for your local chain auto parts store to stock all the parts you need. Why endure often pointless or seemingly intimidating questions like, is your Odyssey an LX or an EX, and wait while the person behind the counter orders the parts on their computer, choosing the only brand their warehouse happens to carry? You have computers with access to rockauto.com at home and right in your pocket. Save time and save money when using Rock Auto. Why would you choose to spend 30%, 50%, even 100% more for the same parts from a chain store or a car dealership? Go to rockauto.com right now and see all the parts available for your car or truck. Make sure you write Locked On in their How Did You Hear About Us box so they know that we sent you. They have amazing selection, reliably low prices, and all the parts your car will ever need over at rockauto.com. The next one today comes from Justin, who says, do you think Gabe Davis is the beneficiary of Dawson Knox being out 3 weeks? And do you think there will be heaps of four wide receiver sets? Last question, Joe, what is your take on Ed Oliver as a top 10 pick? He doesn't seem like a difference maker to me. He hasn't played bad, but not good enough for a top 10 pick. As a pass rusher, he seems non-existent to me. Hughes, Russo, Epinesa, Addison, Zimmer, and Basham have more pressures than Oliver. And with Star back, Oliver was supposed to shine since he would be back to getting one-on-ones. All right, so let's start with Gabe Davis being the beneficiary of the Dawson Knox injury. And I think that is very, very fair to say. Davis has really faded in this offense, and that's something that kind of started last year a little bit towards the end of the season, and why so many of us, including myself, thought that Emmanuel Sanders would definitely have more opportunity than Davis. And Davis is just not a guy that profiles to a similar type role that Emmanuel Sanders is in. I mean, he's not that type of route runner. He's not a vertical threat in terms of being able to separate with speed alone. And, you know, he's not much of a yards after catch type player. What Gabe Davis does present is size and ball skills down the field. And when he's able to be found on a scramble drill by Josh Allen or in a one-on-one situation, I mean, that's where Gabe Davis really excels. And so I think he will get more opportunities now with Knox being out of the lineup and the Bills maybe go more 10 personnel. I still think that the Bills will want to preserve a lot of the utilization of Dawson Knox, particularly as a blocker. And so you'll see Tommy Sweeney picking up a lot of those types of opportunities. But in terms of market share in the passing game and more four wide receiver sets, yeah, I think this is very, very possible. And I do think that Gabe Davis will have a real opportunity here to make some plays, and I hope he does well. As for your Ed Oliver take, I think it's fair to say that Ed Oliver hasn't lived up to being a top 10 pick, but I do think that he's a good starter. I think he's a good player for the Bills. I think he makes plays. I think he has an impact on the game. Has he become this dominant penetration style three technique that nobody can block? No, he hasn't done that. He hasn't done that yet for sure. But I think he's a good starter. So if you can separate what you expected from him as a top 10 pick from what he is in terms of being a good player, then I think you can see him more favorably. But if the expectation for Ed Oliver is always going to be, hey, you have to be an upper echelon defensive tackle that is a game wrecker, you know, I don't think he's shown that. And so I think that's where it's fair to have like some level of disappointment, but also some level of perspective and understanding that it's not like he's a bust. It's not like he's not making an impact. He's just not necessarily doing it to the level expected of a top 10 pick. I think he's a reasonable starting three technique in the NFL. Next one comes from David. David says, it's taken me a week to get over the Bills' loss on Monday night, but I finally think I have, so I went back and started listening to last week's episodes of Locked On Bills to get me through it all. I have to say, though, that I was quite surprised that you didn't mention the three blown holding calls on Derrick Henry's 76-yard run, even if only to dismiss them as part of the game. Yet you chastise a listener in herd mentality for talking about how the Bills held Henry pretty well if you don't count the two long runs, saying you have to count everything to get the real picture. You then mused in your prediction recap on if Greg Russo had done this, if Tremaine Edmonds had done that on that play, that it might have been a different game. Well, if you count any one of those three calls, one that was quite blatant, it's also a very different game. If we are to count everything to get the whole picture, then we should really count everything, including terrible refereeing that makes an impact on the game. I'd love to hear your thoughts and go Bills. I appreciate you following up with this, David, and I am not afraid to respond to things that don't settle well with people. And so thank you for giving me the opportunity to respond to your thoughts on the way I addressed not talking about those blown holding calls. And I think one thing that's been very consistent about the way I respond to football games is that I very rarely talk about officiating on this podcast. It's not something that I bring up very often. And from a Bills perspective, there's not really anything they can do about it. So instead, my analysis is focused on what the Bills can control. And so when I'm talking about why the Bills gave up a 76-yard touchdown run to Derrick Henry, I'm not going to focus on penalties that we think should have been called. I'm focusing on Greg Rousseau being reach blocked, pinned inside, and getting washed down the line of scrimmage. So much so that Matt Milano cannot scrape over top of a block to get into the gap because of that. I'm focused on Levi Wallace and the false step that he took before filling downhill and triggering against the run. It took himself out of the play because he false stepped and didn't get downhill quick enough. Didn't take a good angle. I'm focusing on Trey White and how he had to do a better job of aggressively taking on that block in space to force Derrick Henry to slow his feet and allow the Bills defenders and the pursuit to catch up. I'm focusing on Micah Hyde taking a bad angle. That's the stuff that the Bills can correct. That's the stuff that they can learn from. There's nothing they can do about penalties not being called. But I can point to several, I mean, those are four things off the top of my head that happened on that play that resulted in Derrick Henry going 76 yards. So I don't spend a lot of time griping about officiating. I can understand why people thought there were holds on that play. But I'm more concerned about what the Bills did to contribute to Derrick Henry being able to rip off a 76-yard run than I am hoping for holding calls. Officiating is what it is. Let's talk about what the team can do better. And that's what I focused on. The next one comes from Justin, who says, "Hey Joe, love the podcast. And the failed home run throwback by the Titans last Monday night brought back some memories, and I'm wondering if you went through something similar. We're about the same age, as I was born in November of 86. I just remember the Bills being awesome and everyone being sad at Super Bowl parties when I was little. I didn't really start following them closely until the Johnson Flutie days. Still have the Flutie Flakes cereal box, but I'll admit I was Team Johnson in the debate. My first real sports heartbreak was the Music City Miracle, as I felt whoever won that game was Super Bowl bound, as the Colts and Jaguars were paper tigers. Our defense was awesome. That feeling of extreme joy to utter despair is something I never experienced before, and I didn't take it well at the time. When the refs didn't reverse the call, I threw the remote and it ricocheted off the wall and hit my sister in the face. I then went to my room and cried. It was an important lesson to me that I'd become too involved with the Bills, and I vowed to never get that emotionally involved again. Easier said than done. The closest feeling I've had going from an extreme high to an extreme low for the Bills since that forward pass was the Cardinals game last year, and I handled it much better. My questions to you are, did you go through something similar when that play happened? Given your demeanor, you probably took it a lot better than me, even at a young age. Do you think having social media available makes heartbreaking losses easier to process because you can share the miserable feeling with more people? Thanks for reading and go Bills." So I do remember the Music City Miracle and some of the dynamics that happened in the situation that I was in. So I was watching the game with just my older brother, Frank, and my parents were out of town. My dad was a carpenter and he was building something at the beach, and my mom went with him. And so they watched the game where they were. We watched the game at home. And so when the Bills took the lead, my dad called and we were celebrating the Bills winning a playoff game. And so we're on the phone with my dad, and we all know what happens. So after the play was not reversed, my brother punched the wall, injured his hand, and then he went outside and went on a jog. And I didn't see him for a long time. And so I remember being on the phone with my parents and them just being stunned, my brother punching something and leaving the house, and I was just sitting there alone. That's what I remember. And I think that moment helps me have the demeanor that I do today. Because I remember the way that I felt being concerned about my brother and being home by myself while my parents were out of town. And I just didn't like the way that I felt. It was a very unsettling feeling. And, you know, I wasn't that old. What was I, 12 or something like that? It was weird. It was extremely weird. And so when I think about the Music City Miracle and those dynamics, when I think about the Leotis McKelvin fumble game, and my dad after that game, he was very upset. He said he wasn't going to be a Bills fan anymore, and he took every Bills piece of gear that he had, or shirts or, different paraphernalia, and put it in a big black garbage bag and put it in the hallway of our house and said, anything that you guys want, take it tonight because in the morning I'm throwing this out. And that's exactly what he did. And so I remember the way that that made me feel. And so seeing those things happen, being around people that are extremely emotional during the game, it makes me not want to be that way. And I don't want my wife to ever be concerned about my emotional state because the Bills didn't win a football game. I don't want my daughter to ever feel weird. I want to create an environment where my daughter is excited to watch football with me and we enjoy all the great things about football and how fun it is to be a fan. And I want to compartmentalize all of that. I want to keep everything that's good about fandom and enjoy that. And when things are disappointing, they're disappointing. But I refuse to let myself be sad or emotionally distraught because of the result of a football game. I just don't want to be that type of person. I love football. I love football. I love the Bills so much. I've made it my life. My life's work is literally football and the Buffalo Bills. And I just refuse to let the bad parts of it, right? The losses, the inevitable losses, affect me emotionally or have it impact the way I treat people. I'm just not going to do it. And so I want football to be a net positive to my life. And the reality is, there's 32 NFL teams, 31 teams, their season ends in disappointment. 31 of them. You either stink and didn't make the playoffs, you make the playoffs and lose, or you win the Super Bowl. One team wins a Super Bowl. So you have to just have that perspective. And I want football to be a very healthy thing in my life. And I want it to be something that I enjoy with my family. And I think the way that I act, the way that I respond to things within football games will have a big impact on the family dynamics and whether or not my daughter grows up to love football. And my wife is happy and enjoys the fact that I get to do this for a living. So that's kind of my thoughts on that. As far as social media, one thing that I'll give you a piece of advice if you'll have it. When the Bills lose, don't give people the meltdown on Twitter. When you see other teams lose, don't you kind of enjoy watching other fan bases meltdown? And you see them all distraught about their team? Just remember that when it's us. Don't give it to people. Don't give it to people. You lose a game, like everybody's going to run to your Twitter account or your social media handles and they want to see you upset and losing your mind. Don't give them the meltdown. Ask yourself good questions about why the loss happened and what those reasons are and if those reasons are concerning and how that impacts things moving forward. But I would fight. If I were you, I would fight to make sure that football remains a net positive in your life and you enjoy what it brings to your life. The next one comes from Dean. Dean says, not a question, but just some comments related to the big picture. I know it always stings when the Bills lose, and a lot of us get concerned about what that loss might mean. But if we go back to the beginning of the 2019 season and look at the big picture, the Bills are one of, if not the most competitive team in the NFL. In 42 games going back to that, they've only lost by more than 10 points three times. The 2020 AFC Championship game, 2020 against the Titans, 2019 against the Eagles. Every other game, they were within a score late in the fourth quarter. Compare the same time frame for the Chiefs and the Packers, two of the most successful teams recently, and they've both been blown out five times each in that same period. I just think that this really shows how competitive this team is, how good the coaching is, and the fact that we are hardly ever out of a game with Josh at the helm. Keep up the great work. Love your daily podcast. Looking forward to a number of Victory Mondays in the weeks ahead. Great perspective, Dean. Great perspective. Last one today comes from Stan, and Stan has some good questions here. I can't answer all of them, but I will give you the information that I can. Stan says, hey, thank you for keeping us all going and your tireless Bills content efforts. My question is in regards to the show itself, sort of giving us a view inside. Can you give us a scouting report for the podcast to look at what you're seeing in terms of listeners and trends? For instance, how many people tune in for each show? And so Stan has a bunch of questions. I'm going to answer them as I read through them. So how many people tune in for each show? I will tell you this. Over the last 30 days, Locked On Bills has had 80,000 unique listeners. So 80,000 different people listened to Locked On Bills in the last 30 days. Stan asks, how has this evolved over time? And the answer to that is significantly. Month to month, compared to 2020, we're up on average this year about 60% every month. And versus 2019, we're up 160% on average per month. So the show has wonderful growth. Stan then asks, how many listeners are you adding every season? I'll tell you that the growth has been very linear. It's done very, very well. Stan then asks, where are some surprising places people are tuning in from? I'll give you the top 10 countries. United States, by far and away, number one. Canada, two. The United Kingdom, three. Denmark, Australia, Mexico, Germany, Brazil, Japan, Sweden. Those are the top 10 countries in terms of listens to the podcast. Stan then says, are there any clusters of Bills fans outside of Buffalo located somewhere interesting? So I'll give you the top 10 states that people listen to the podcast from. New York, obviously, number one. Ontario, California, Florida, North Carolina, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Colorado. And some cities that we have a surprising amount of listenership, Denver, Colorado, Las Vegas, Nevada, Phoenix, Arizona, Raleigh, North Carolina, Charlotte, North Carolina is very, very big. And then Tampa Bay. There's quite a few listeners down in Tampa Bay. The next one is, what are the weekly trends that change week to week? For example, losing weeks or winning weeks. I'll say this. When the Bills lose, there's about a 30% dip in listenership. Stan then asks, is there a most popular episode of all time? The top 10 most listened to episodes of all time for Locked On Bills. Number one, Victory Monday against the Chiefs this year. Number two is Victory Monday against the Washington football team this year. Number three is Victory Monday against the Dolphins this year, the 35-0 win. The next one is the loss to the Steelers, so not Victory Monday, just a recap pod. The preseason win over the Bears this year. Victory Monday over Houston, the 40-0 win this year. Herd Mentality 135, the Steelers primer for week one. The podcast after the Bills drafted Gregory Rousseau, and then the Titans primer rounds out the top 10. And then lastly, Stan says, or are there any other patterns, numbers, or trends that you feel would be cool to share? Thanks again for all that you do, and thanks for being such a steadying voice for the Bills community. I'll end with this. The growth of this show has been absolutely amazing, and it has absolutely changed my life. I'm so thankful to everyone who listens and makes it possible for me to get to do this work. I absolutely love it. It's a total joy. And I love doing this podcast every day for you. And I can't believe I get to do it. I'm so glad that I took the opportunity back in January of 2019. This podcast has absolutely changed my life. And I have everyone listening to this podcast to thank for it. All right, so that's going to do it for us here today on the podcast. Tomorrow, we turn our attention to the Miami Dolphins, the Bills' next opponent. And so we're going to break them down and some of the challenges that exist this time around facing Miami compared to week two. So don't miss it. Make sure you're subscribed, rate, review, and share the podcast. Have a great day, and I look forward to catching up with you again tomorrow.